This episode of Dummy is sponsored by Audible. You can get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/holler. There are more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can play them from your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. To get your free audiobook and support this podcast, just visit audibletrial.com/holler.
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a twice-weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler. Joining me in the tiniest studio in all of Miami is still the only member of this podcast to have scored a goal for Arsenal. He's now a scout for the Gunners, Danny Carbassian. Hey, Danny.
How's it going, George?
Could be better. David Goldblatt, the author of The Ball is Round and Futsal Nation, joins us from Bristol, England, not Connecticut. David, hi.
Good evening.
Coming up on the show, we will talk about a truly memorable night for the U.S. men's national team. Anxiety, heartbreak, hope, pride, I guess, is what we can come away with, maybe. Of course, Tim Howard. And that's really all I need to say about this game, Tim Howard. We'll also take a quick look around the rest of the World Cup, including the keepers who have sort of stolen the show so far in the knockout stages. We have a quick piece from Alan Black, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and Howler Magazine's resident curmudgeon, about what it's like supporting a team that's not even playing in the World Cup. And finally, we'll talk to Emilio Bruna. Emilio is a professor in the Wildlife Ecology and Conservation Department at the University of Florida. He's the editor-in-chief of the academic journal Biotropica. We'll talk to him about how Brazil is not exactly following through on some promises it made about environmental conservation for the World Cup and what a group of people are doing to change that. So plenty to talk about, but of course we have to start with the game that just ended. We're recording this minutes after Belgium shocked the United States and sent them packing from the World Cup in the round of 16. Okay, so the stat that we should talk about is not that the U.S. had 53% possession, according to FIFA's website. But I think that Tim Howard had more saves than any goalkeeper in any World Cup game since 1966, which is incredible. Danny, is that a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good thing in terms of trying to keep the score down. But when it comes to the fact that your goalkeeper's having to make all these huge saves, I mean, something else isn't going well. Tim, I thought, was absolutely fantastic. I mean, you have to be silly not to think that he wasn't. But as we said, you know, Belgium came, they attacked so well. They have so many options going up front, and their movement off the ball was excellent. Origi's hold-up play was fantastic, which actually brought in the rest of their attacking force, which forced Tim Howard into making all sorts of saves throughout the night. But, you know, it was a big test for the team, and I thought, you know, as you said, like, a lot of pride was on the line. I thought they did really well, but Tim Howard did have to make some massive saves throughout the night.
David, you and I spoke really briefly before we started recording. You were giddy. Was this one of the best games in the tournament, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a kind of taste for backs-to-the-wall siege mentality, impossible odds kind of game, and it delivered it. It's amazing to watch people, you know, with the way they play, put their heart on their sleeves and, as the cliche goes, really give everything. And I mean, I'd actually given up, you know, halfway through, through extra time. I thought that's it, 2-0. And the last 12 minutes of the game were just sensational, fueled by the most kind of ludicrous thoughts of possibility and hope. And, you know, crudely put, that's what you pay your money for, no?
Yeah, so one thought is, why didn't we do that from the beginning? And then the other thought is, if we had done that from the beginning, we would have gotten roasted even worse because, you know, we wouldn't have been defending at all. We would have left ourselves wide open for counterattacking and, you know, a guy like Hazard, who is so fast, so skillful. I tend to agree with Danny that, you know, Tim Howard was spectacular, but the fact that he needed to make all those saves is a really damning, it's a really damning piece of evidence there for the U.S. team. We weren't organized enough to keep Belgium out. They were getting through. If you look at Courtois, he made some great saves as well, but nowhere near what Howard was called on to do just because we weren't getting close enough to take those shots.
Yeah, I thought, I think this was definitely the U.S.'s toughest game. And that's saying, you know, we played Germany, Portugal, and Ghana in our group, which obviously speaks loads about our group. But what Belgium did really well, what I think the other teams haven't been able to do, and we spoke about this last time, was Germany played with a false nine as well. And Belgium, through Origi, had a huge, strong central, you know, out-and-out striker up there who, as I said, was able to hold the ball up and then bring these guys in, like Hazard, De Bruyne, and Mertens as well. And these guys are all very, very good on the ball. They're able to go outside and put a cross in, and they're able to come inside as well. And Michael Ballack said right after the game, when they asked him, they said, what do you think about the game? He said the U.S. has to get better technically. And I think that was the biggest thing that just stuck out, is how comfortable Belgium are on the ball. I mean, there are points in the game where, and I know Hazard's meant to be one of the best players in the world, and you see him on the ball, and he just has the ball, and the U.S. players have to respect him so much because of the amount of options that he has when he is on the ball. And at one point...
And you don't mean options, you know, to pass the ball off. You mean options to beat them.
To beat them, yeah. I mean, he can pass if he wants, or he can go left if he wants, he can go right if he wants, he can shoot if he wants. And you see it because he got the ball, and at one point he was just about 25 yards out and actually walking with the ball towards the defender. And that defender is, you know, down in his defensive stance, like still worried, and Hazard's essentially standing straight up.
Right.
And you still don't know what's going to happen.
David, you mentioned that the English commentators had some really nice things to say about the U.S. national team. What were they saying about the team during
well,
the game?
Well, I was watching BBC, and the professional Yorkshireman, the gruff Danny Murphy, who you'll know, I'm sure, from Fulham, said, you know, not grudgingly, actually, he said of the U.S. team, oh, they're a proper team, and these are proper fans.
Yeah, and my response to that is, I don't know if I want to be praised by the English for our grit and determination, because look how far that's gotten you guys.
if only there'd been so much grit and determination. As they say, you know, if you'd have offered me that before the match, I'd have bitten your hand off.
Yeah, no, that's true. What do we think about the substitutions? Jozy Altidore was clearly a mirage, something that Klinsmann was using to strike fear into the hearts of Belgians all over the world.
Yeah, so I guess Fabian Johnson, well, Klinsmann was forced into making the first change when Fabian Johnson went off with another hamstring. Yedlin came on and did really well. You know, he kind of added on to the performances that he's given in the previous games, was able to get up and down that right-hand side, and, you know, gave Hazard a run for his money in terms of pace and quickness at times. And even when Hazard, I thought he was through a couple of times, Yedlin recovered quite well and put in a good tackle. Wando came on as well and arguably missed the biggest chance of the game, especially for us, which is frustrating. But any striker, you know, will have to just bounce back and get over that and try to forget it as quick as possible. And then, of course, Julian Green came on and scored that goal, which we'll probably remember forever.
Yeah, so let's talk about the substitutions first. I want to talk about David. So, listeners, I don't know if you know this, but when you picture David, you should picture a guy with dreadlocks. And I want to talk about your brother in dreadlocks. Kyle Beckerman was not chosen to start this game after having a really good tournament. Three very, very solid games where I think he surprised a lot of people who thought maybe he couldn't hack it at this level.
Yeah, and the best white man dreadlocks in the tournament as well.
That is definitely true.
Surprising not to see him. He'd been fearsome in the tackle, very solid. You know, something really strong in the middle. I didn't really get it. What's your thoughts? Why not play the dude?
It's a really good question. I'm not sure if it has... I'll offer my hypothesis, which is that it wasn't as much about Beckerman's shortcomings as about Jeff Cameron's strengths in the middle. Cameron is a good, I would say, I'm eyeballing here, but 6 inches taller than Kyle Beckerman, and offers maybe a little bit more defensive and offensive power in the air. And so that's one idea that I have. Otherwise, I can't honestly tell you why Kyle Beckerman wasn't playing in that game.
Yeah, I thought another thing, another reason I thought he played, probably because Hazard, Mertens, all these guys are quite quick, and I think the pace of the game was always going to be really, really quick. With that said, Beckerman did really well against Ghana as well, and that game wasn't slow. So it was a bit puzzling, especially after his first three appearances, but
I think one thing we missed with him out was someone who could provide a little bit of the the calm passing that we've been missing in the middle. It felt a little bit like a wasteland in there, you know, just up and back. The U.S. went through a stretch in the first half, especially where it felt like we were just getting the ball out to the halfway line and then bunkering down for another onslaught from Belgium. And someone who could maybe keep the ball, pass it around, just be a calm presence in the midfield was something that we were missing.
Yeah, I think immediately when you're playing in the midfield as opposed to playing in the back as Cameron has in the previous games, when you're in the back, you can kind of just, you know, play simple balls and let the midfielders do it. And I think when you do get yourself in the midfield and find yourself there, you think immediately that those creative balls rest on your shoulders. And I think at times, like, you saw Cameron get the ball and then just clip a ball into space, like down the right hand side or down the left hand side, where we've had you know, some good results in the past couple games, but it just wasn't on, and as you said, they did feel forced, whereas Kyle Beckerman probably would have just, you know, played a square ball or just retained possession a little bit better. And as you said, it's that little calm in the midfield. And the last team you want to do this against is Belgium, who were obviously ready to come right back down our throats every time we lost the ball.
Right. So, David, are you puzzled at all about Chris Wondolowski? As someone who hasn't seen him play very much in MLS, I would imagine.
No, I haven't seen a lot of him before. He's new to me.
Yeah. You know, when he came on, and he's just for background, he's a great goal scorer in Major League Soccer. He's scored a ton of goals for a not terribly great team. And yet everyone in the room where I was watching the game groaned when they saw him coming on. I was a little bit puzzled about, you know, why Josie wasn't coming on if he were really available, which clearly he was not. But also Aaron Johansson seems like he blew his chance in the first game and hasn't featured again. And so I don't know what's going on there, but, you know, Danny pointed this out when we were watching the game. You know, if you're Belgium, you can bring on Lukaku as a substitute. And the U.S. down, you know, maybe not down a goal, he came on when we were tied, but needing a goal brings on Chris Wondolowski. And I just, you know, his best and possibly only chance was at the very end of regulation time when he missed a point blank shot that the linesman was raising his flag anyway to call offside, but Wondolowski missed the shot. It would have been wrongly offside. But that to me was just sort of, at this level, those margins are so thin. That's the kind of shot you have to make. You have to score that goal.
Yeah. And, I think so. Lukaku comes on as a sub and right away it's just like this injection of power, as if there wasn't enough power and pace up front with Origi already. Lukaku comes off the bench and once again provides that option. Where they could play the ball in and hold it up and bring those guys in. And we just didn't have that throughout. And maybe he brings on Wondolowski. Well, he did bring on Wondolowski to allow Clint to kind of drop in and be able to run at players again. And when he did that, Bradley dropped off as well. And that's when we actually started playing our best, ironically. You know, I know we all keep saying, was Wondolowski the right option? But when he did come on, all of a sudden the U.S. looked like we had something in the attack. But yeah, in terms of just depth, it's pretty frightening to see that they have Belgium have Origi, who's the 19-year-old, and then Benteke, who's 24, and Lukaku, who's 21. It's just it's pretty startling that they have that much talent up front.
So I know, David, you are a neutral observer here, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. performance overall, I believe Belgium had as many shots tonight as the U.S. team had in the entire tournament. It wasn't a great showing. We had one win, a tie, two losses. I think we got our money's worth entertainment-wise out of that kind of performance. But if you're talking about challenging for the World Cup or even to get into the final eight, we have a ways to go. I don't know.
Well, the way I would put it is, you know, if you are going to challenge for the World Cup and are going to create a league that is challenging with the best of the European and the South American leagues, you know, partly that's about building up a cadre of technically brilliant players, but much, much more than that, it's about building a level of kind of audience appeal that's going to sustain that in the long term. And while, you know, as you rightly say, it was not an exhibition of technical excellence, you know, if it's about winning hearts and minds, then it's a pretty exceptional performance.
Yeah, no, that's true. And part of the struggle here, part of the mission of a World Cup is not just to perform on the field, but to increase awareness, increase the number of fans. I think that even a losing effort can do that when you see the team really just playing, clearly trying and clearly going for it. Americans love that, as they should. I mean, it's a really admirable quality of our team. And I think it's one of the only defining things, a thing that you can say is truly American about soccer here, is that we were beaten and we didn't know it. And we're unbeaten because of that. And that's a really kind of amazing thing that I think other country fan bases would love to have in their teams that maybe isn't there. So a quick word about goalkeepers. France, Germany is interesting because they have, we'll see two goalkeepers there who like to play with the ball at their feet. We all saw Manuel Neuer against Algeria take 21 touches outside of his penalty area. And I think every time he did it, I was just thinking to myself, again, like, hasn't Jogi
And the
Love...
goal, the goal that he made, I mean, that, you know, his goal kick was like a fabulous kind of upfield pass that made the goal, no?
Of course, and Hugo Lloris is also famous for being able to play with his feet, you know, relieving pressure for Spurs and playing almost as a sweeper for them. And so we're going to see that. But I want to call out the goalkeepers who have really made an impression. I would say Tim Howard, obviously, Memo Ochoa in the group stage, Vincent Anyema for Nigeria had an amazing game against France. Mm-hmm. And of course, and I want to make sure I'm saying this right, Rais Mboli for Algeria had a great game as well. Now, Danny and I were talking about before the podcast, these goalkeepers all had excellent games. They all are also out of the tournament. So, you know, I'm not sure that you want to be calling attention to yourself as a goalkeeper, even if it's in a good, way.
Yeah. If you're having a wonderful game, then it means you're probably getting peppered. So it's probably not the best of things. But what is great about it, though, is the fact that there have been all these great saves, but there's also been all these great goals too. So not only has it been a tournament where kind of goalkeepers have shined, but there's also been some amazing goals as well, you know? So those keepers will definitely be missed, but there's a couple keepers left in the tournament that can definitely turn heads still.
Well, it sounds counterintuitive, right? Because you think, oh, if the goalkeepers are shining, then there probably aren't many goals being scored. But I think you have to have a really attacking, goal-filled tournament in order for goalkeepers once in a while to make an impression.
And a penalty shootout or two. Let's, you know, not forget Julio Cesar, you know, has carried Brazil through to the quarterfinals.
That's right. This is both the tournament of the goal scorer and the tournament of the goalkeeper, which is kind of amazing. It's time to move this discussion off the field. Up next, we have Emilio Bruna, a professor at the University of Florida. He's going to tell us about some of the environmental promises the Brazilian government made in their World Cup bid. You may be able to guess they are not being fulfilled. Okay, I'm joined by Emilio Bruna. He is a professor of tropical ecology and Latin American studies at the University of Florida. He's also the editor-in-chief of the scientific journal Biotropica. Biotropica is a journal about the ecosystem. And you published a story in the May issue that has to do with Brazil's ecosystem and something to do with Fuleca, the mascot of the World Cup. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Thanks for having me on. Felipe Melo from the Federal University of Pernambuco and several of his colleagues wrote a really interesting essay in which they basically called out the Brazilian government for failing to live up to several of the environmental commitments it made as part of its bid to host the World Cup. For lots of major sporting events, sustainability has become a really important component of the bid package. And that usually is things like offsetting the carbon emissions that come from transporting the teams and the players and the tourists around, or it could be things like having solar panels on the stadia, or even things like recycling and waste. In fact, for this World Cup, having tobacco-free stadiums is part of the sustainability initiative. But for this World Cup, which is being hosted by Brazil, which is known for its really exuberant biodiversity, the Brazilian government wanted to do something really special, which is highlight not just things like recycling and carbon offsets, but the biodiversity of Brazil itself. This was going to be really central to their bid process. And as part of doing that, they had as their mascot, Fuleco, which is the three-banded armadillo. It's a highly endangered species of armadillo, which is found in an ecosystem called the Caatinga in northeastern Brazil, which is itself highly endangered. The really cool thing about this species of armadillo is that when it needs to defend itself from predator, it rolls up into a ball. So it's the perfect mascot for a soccer tournament. And it's obviously a great mascot to represent Brazil's commitment to protecting its environment. And so this was the idea to put this front and center.
Emilio, tell me about the promises that Brazil made, and what is the timeline for starting to fulfill those promises?
They made lots of the usual promises, carbon offsets, efficient stadia, things like that. But one of the really important things that they promised to do was to build up the infrastructure in Brazil's national, state, and municipal parks so that tourists could go and visit them. Now, Brazil has probably the largest protected area network in the world, but a lot of these parks have no staff, no funding, and very little infrastructure. So it's not something tourists can take advantage of if they actually go to visit. So one of the promises that they made, they were going to improve the infrastructure of about 45 protected areas. By a year later, they'd already whittled it down to 16 areas, and only 2% of the funding had been released to do that. Another thing that they wanted to do was to develop a conservation plan for the mascot, the armadillo, and that wasn't done either. So they fell behind almost immediately, like they did with a lot of the other promises that were made, both the socioeconomic development and also the broader environmental goals as well.
So I think people naturally focus on the hardships of the people involved, the people who are being whose homes are being torn down, who are, or, you know, organizing for human rights infrastructure and, you know, just things that make their lives easier. I guess it would be hard maybe to drum up support for making Brazil follow through on the promises it made about the ecosystem. But then again, the ecosystem in Brazil is extremely important to the rest of the world. Can you explain a little bit about how connected a society like the United States might be to what goes on in Brazil's sort of wild areas?
Brazil has some of the most remarkable and largest ecosystems in the world. So we've got the Amazon, we've got the Pantanal, which is basically a swamp the size of France. You've got the Caatinga in the northeast, which is a giant dry woodland, which is home to 20 million people. Some of them are the poorest people in the world. It's incredibly biodiversity rich. The Atlantic forests that used to cover about 10% of Brazil. We've got the Cerrado, which is the giant savannas in the central part of Brazil. This is Brazil's breadbasket and what's turned it into an agricultural superpower. So the protection of the environment in Brazil and the way in which Brazil promotes environmental stewardship influences climate throughout the world. It influences agricultural commodities and their pricing throughout the world. And of course, those people who live in those ecosystems, which is the majority of Brazilians, are going to depend on them for ecosystem services like clean water, clean air, and the products that they use both locally and export. There is no way to separate Brazil's environment and the protection of that environment from its own socioeconomic development and then the way in which it reaches out to the rest of the world.
So, Emilio, what are the prospects for Brazil actually making some of these promises come to fruition and beefing up the infrastructure and the resources available to these national state parks and actually doing something to make the ecosystem better there?
I think that Mello and his colleagues did something really smart, which is that one of the things they put forward in their essay was the idea that Brazil should protect 1,000 hectares. 1,000 hectares is about 2,500 acres for every single goal that's scored in the World Cup of the mascot's habitat, which is highly critically endangered. This caught a lot of attention in Brazilian media. It was picked up by a blogger for the Estado de São Paulo, which is one of the most important newspapers in Brazil. His blog post promoting the idea that you could protect 1,000 hectares of habitat with every goal that's scored, which, by the way, if you went with previous World Cups, would end up being about 171,000 hectares. So a very respectable piece of this habitat would be protected. His original Facebook post was then shared by over 20,000 people. So it caught on like wildfire. It's gone crazy on social media. It's starting to get attention in broader media outlets internationally. And almost within 3 weeks of the essay being published, although there's no direct link necessarily, the Brazilian government has already put out a management plan for this endangered species and the protection of its habitat, which they're going to move forward with within the next 6 months. So I think that their essay has already really had an impact, in part because of what this mascot was supposed to do, which was attract people's attention. It's a great mascot. People love it. And these authors were able to use that appeal that it has to the public to jumpstart the conservation of this species and its habitat. And And this World Cup, if they were to go with the 1,000 hectares per goal target, would actually be even better, because as of this afternoon's games, I think we've scored something like 147. I wasn't exactly on the field, but the teams have scored 147 goals so far. So if the Brazilian government were to pick up that challenge, I think we could do a lot to conserve this species and its environment.
Excellent. So we'll have links to the paper and some of the media around it on our page. Emilio Bruna, professor of tropical ecology and Latin American studies at the University of Florida. Thank you so much for joining us on Dummy.
Hey, I had a great time. Thanks a lot.
The World Cup is a celebration of soccer for all the teams playing, but it's a little bittersweet for the ones on the outside looking in. Alan Black joins us next for his take on supporting a team that didn't even make it into the tournament.
Some countries don't get to go to the World Cup. Take Scotland, for example, where I'm from. This summer we've seen enough samba-dancing Brazilians, chilled-out Chileans, Dutch partiers in Copacabana Beach, and Yanks yelling, "Stop it!" We have to sit at home twiddling our thumbs. The only solace? Seeing a Scottish guy on TV in amongst a crowd of Uruguayans, waving the Scottish flag, delirious with joy, for a goal that Uruguay have just scored against England. Is this what it's boiled down to? Nations that never go to the World Cup, or it's been so long no one can remember being there, now reduced to laughing at other people's misfortunes. England! Oh, come on. The Scots invented soccer. We gave the world the passing game. We beat the English before George Washington. Come on. Please give us a ticket to the ball. No. Yes, we are stuck on that list of forgotten World Cup nations. Check off names like Luxembourg and Liechtenstein and San Marino. You'll have to look them up in the remote part of the Atlas. Now we can go back to twiddling our thumbs and laughing at others' misfortunes.
My heart is set and I'm all alone. My man treats me mean. I regret the day that I was born, and that man I ever...
Okay, that almost does it for us, but before we go, I want to ask you guys about Tiki Taka this week. I gotta say, I'm a little bit on overload. Soccer is everywhere, and it's hard to pick out really good things, but I'm sure we have some. Danny, you just showed me something you're gonna talk about. It's pretty good. What is it?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about and we keep talking about the support for the U.S., but more so on a global scale. I thought it's been awesome throughout the tournament how whenever a goal is scored or a game is won, the cameras will go to, you know, Mexico City or the Zocalo, or they'll go to Paris, or they go to Chicago, D.C., all these cities, and everywhere is just absolutely packed. And what made me say that was there was an article in the Alaskan News or something where they opened up an auditorium and they're selling tickets, and it's a 400-seater auditorium that's selling out for these soccer games, which is pretty awesome.
So I'm sure now that FIFA knows about that, they're going to come in and get their cut.
Exactly.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, and you showed me a picture of, what was it, Dallas?
It was, yeah, Dallas, the Cowboy Stadium is just completely full watching the U.S. game just now.
Amazing, on the big, humongous,
huge screen.
Cube that descends from the sky. Okay, David, how do you want to follow that up?
Well, funnily enough, that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. It's been just the most extraordinary celebrations around the world that have been catching my eye. And downtown Algiers, at the moment that Algeria qualified for the second round, was just engulfed in fireworks and magnesium flames and people leaping and dancing. And that was pretty extraordinary stuff. I also like the way that, people deal with defeat as well and what that tells us. And I noted that Vladimir Putin, who does like to back a winner, claimed that he didn't even watch Russia's game with Belgium.
Wait, why? Because he thought that he enigmatically
said no more, man. He's the prez. He doesn't have to explain. He just says.
Okay. Well, so as long as he doesn't try to force everyone else in the country to stop watching soccer.
They showed Obama here cheering, "I believe that we can win." It's a slightly different.
Oh, boy. He's going to get killed in the... I guess he doesn't have to run for election anymore.
Nope.
Red states will not like that. Okay. Well, I want to talk about... I know I've used him before, Bobby Warshaw, and the stuff I've edited. He had a piece that went up on Deadspin today about having played against Kyle Beckerman that was really amazing. I think something that I love about this is this window into some of the trash talk and just conversation that goes on among players on the field that the cameras don't pick it up. You know, you even now have Messi and those guys sort of covering their mouths when they talk, so that no one can read what they're saying on their lips. Bobby writes about having played against Kyle Beckerman when he was a little younger, and Kyle Beckerman just trash talking him the whole time. And the thing that was really funny is that Kyle Beckerman kept calling Bobby Warshaw a young cock, which I don't even know what that is. Like, I'm not even sure. I don't know. So what would throw me off about that? If Kyle Beckerman was calling me a name, I could get over that. I could handle that. I would be like, okay, you know, he's calling me a dirty name. I can, you know I'm a decent soccer player. I'm just going to keep playing. What I find really distressing about this is that I don't know what that means. And I would be wondering the whole time. I would want to ask him. That would probably play into his mind games. Like, I'm showing weakness because I don't know. And yet I don't actually think it's a real thing. I think it's a name Kyle Beckerman makes up to throw younger players off their games. Danny, were you ever called a young cock?
I was never, and like you, I'm not 100% sure what that means.
Were you ever, like, is that a tactic that other teams use? Like, when you went to play in England, were other defenders like, what were the things they would do to throw you off?
I mean, definitely the trash talk element, it can get in your head, especially if you're a young kid and you come on and you're kind of bright-eyed and everything, and all of a sudden, a guy that you look up to is talking trash to you and running his studs down your Achilles and all that sort of stuff, which is quite common at the top level. But, yeah, I mean, it can, if you're not used to it, but.
See, a Breck Shea being called a young cock would make sense. He's got that sort of rooster like hairdo, but, and just.
The question I want to ask, George, is it better or worse to be an old cock?
You know, maybe Kyle Beckerman thinks of himself as an old cock, and therefore, I really hope that. You know, this podcast is going out on Slate. I really hope that we may have to bleep this out, and it's going to sound like Kyle Beckerman was calling Bobby Warshaw something way worse than a young cock. It's going to, you know, people's imaginations are going to be running wild. But I don't know how we're going to solve this problem. I just hope the censoring isn't that bad. That's great. If you go to Deadspin and just search Bobby Warshaw, Kyle Beckerman, it's really a piece about how Beckerman is the best fouler that Warshaw ever played against, and that's a real skill because that really does throw players off their game. There's a great gif of him grabbing Schweinsteiger's shirt in the game against Germany. Schweinsteiger just like hitting the floor as though he'd been, body slammed by Jermaine Jones. But you know, it's a great little piece, and it gets us onto the field, which is something that not a lot of soccer pieces do. So I really like that. That does it for this episode of Dummy. I want to thank our guests, Emilio Bruna and Alan Black. Thank you also to our panel, David Goldblatt, Danny Carbassian, for joining us all summer. Thanks to Slate, Josh Levine, Mike Vuolo, and Andy Bowers. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you're not following us on Twitter, you should. We're at What a Howler. Same thing for Instagram. The Howler Singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They are members of the choral ensemble Ghostlight, and they made our theme tune. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. This podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson, with help from Ryan Katniss, Kira Deppenbrock, and Melina Barajas. Oh, one other thing I want to mention. I mentioned the Slate guys. If you're listening to this podcast in Howler's feed, you should also check out Hang Up and Listen, which is Slate's really great sports podcast. You may be confused about why I'm thinking Slate. They have put our podcast in their feed all summer, helping us to reach new listeners, and we're really grateful. As I was saying, this podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson with help from Ryan Katniss, Kira Deppenbrock, and Melina Barajas. My name is George Qureshi. I'll be back with you next week along with all the rest of these dummies. Until then, happy World Cup.
Howler Man.
For you, the listeners of Dummy, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial. You'll be supporting this podcast and getting a free audiobook. And all you have to do is sign up at audibletrial.com/holler. That's audibletrial.com/holler.